From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the pandemic leading to a mental health crisis among kids.
From isolation to changes in their routines to just not seeing friends and family, it's been extreme.
COVID-19 boosters, who needs one, who doesn't? Breaking down the guidance from health officials.
I think this really speaks to the challenge that the CDC and the FDA had. And this has been the story of the pandemic, making hard calls with very limited information.
And why some Spanish speakers feel they're treated unfairly for the way they speak.
These students that grew up in the United States, but were never afforded an opportunity to strengthen that home language. They were forced to transition to English. Now we're ridiculing them.
All ahead on Perspective. This week, we got the go-ahead for more COVID boosters, and we're moving toward being able to vaccinate children. That's coming up. But first, we're going to talk about one of the many casualties brought about by the pandemic. Marriage. People are splitting up in record numbers. ABC's Jim Ryan's been talking to some experts about a few of the reasons why.
Love and marriage.
For over a decade, it seemed that Frank Sinatra was right.
Go together like a horse and carriage.
Between 2009 and 2019, the divorce rate fell from 9.7 new divorces per 1,000 women to 7.6 in 2019. And then the pandemic came along. For many couples and families, it was the dawn of a new era in closeness.
It was really a great time to kind of reconnect, pull out the board games, spend time with each other. I think there were a lot of families, it was a great time.
For others, not so much.
If your family was fractured going into the quarantine, now suddenly being forced to be in the same space with each other all the time was really hard.
Divorce lawyer Jennifer Hargrave says pandemic quarantines and lockdowns took away some of the diversions that actually kept some families going.
You know, used to travel for work, you had all these kids' activities, you had girls' night out, whatever. I mean, all those distractions were gone. And so people were just kind of left facing the fact that they were unhappy.
And debates over mask mandates and vaccination requirements crept from cable news channels and city council meetings into homes and bedrooms.
The political divide, you know, different ideas about vaccines and, you know, just too far apart.
But even during self-quarantine, the old standby causes for divorce came into play.
Infidelity is always, you know, when you get caught cheating on your spouse, because locked down their phone or they're going and spending an inordinate amount of time on their phone in the bathroom with the door locked, you know, makes people suspicious.
The result has been a dramatic rise in divorces as COVID infection rates have generally fallen. And for Jennifer Hargrave,
it's good news for divorce lawyers.
Cynicism aside, the breakup of a marriage isn't fun. The ripples flow out to friends and extended families and can leave the children of divorce feeling even more isolated. At the same time, says divorce attorney Jennifer Hargrave,
living in the truth of the situation and getting honest about it and, you know, being motivated to take the changes that you need, that's a good thing. It doesn't have to be a horrible experience. For many people, it can be a really good experience.
Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News.
Despite the lightheartedness of the Frank Sinatra song, the most vulnerable victims of divorce are often children. But even those in loving family relationships have been struggling during the pandemic. Most kids are back in school and with their friends, but a lot of them are still feeling the residual effects, fear, isolation, uncertainty, grief. Young children have been trying to sort out their feelings.
Why do you feel mad, Buglet?
Because of this pandemic thing.
Adolescents have been grappling with what the past 18 months have been like.
I started playing my Xbox way more and turned to my phone to communicate with my friends.
And more than a few parents have wondered, like this mom, if their kids are okay.
He's definitely more anxious. We've had a couple situations where even during just kind of the normal routine of the day, or once we were, with some friends, socially distanced at, you know, a little backyard gathering, and he just kind of froze. And he said a scary thought went through his head. I had to hold him for a little while. And he said, you know, the world's really scary right now.
Here's a shocking statistic. In the first 6 months of this year, children's hospitals across the country reported a 45% increase in the number of self-injury and suicide cases in 5 to 17-year-olds compared to the same period in 2019. Citing an alarming rise in families seeking urgent mental health for their kids and teens, several groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association, have declared a national state of emergency in child and adolescent mental health. Amy Knight is president of the Children's Hospital Association. We talked about it this week.
This really is an extremely serious issue. You're talking about a national emergency declared on children's mental health because of the pandemic. How bad has it gotten?
It's gotten really bad, quite honestly. And I think we need to look even before the pandemic. And, you know, there were a lot of red flags, if you will, over the past couple of decades. For a number of factors, we've seen children's kind of mental health on a decline. You know, if you look at a couple of indicators from roughly 2003 to 2012, you know, we saw anxiety and depression nearly double in kids. And so if you kind of fast forward 10 years and say that would happen again, we probably have, you know, kind of significant diagnosis, like treatment-related diagnoses in about 20% of our children. And if you look at that 10 years since then, during that same time, the suicide rate and children and youth ages 10 to 24, really young adults, has increased by 60%. There's many sorts of mental and behavioral disorders. Some of them are fairly minor, but going untreated, they actually become more significant. And so if we look at some of the data we've seen, what you've seen is really a significant increase in that. So you pile on the pandemic on top of that, from isolation to changes in their routines to just not seeing friends and family, it's been extreme. They've been cut off from services and where they would typically access them in schools or their pediatrician or otherwise. And so as we're coming back with each start of school in a typical year in September, you would see a rise in mental health cases. It's just part of the normal routine. This year, really, we're seeing a lot more.
We talked about the pandemic, but you also mentioned between 2003 and 2012, problems of this sort had doubled. What are the things that are most stressing kids out besides the pandemic?
Probably it's fair to say just life, you know, so I think if we had to look at what some of the crises were, so we saw during that time in children's hospitals who we work with directly, a huge increase in a number of kids showing up in emergency departments, being referred for care. And, you know, I think the factors are multitudes. So if you look at studies today, you can certainly see the rise of social media. Just the flow of information to children is much different in the past 20 years than it was the prior 20 years between the internet and social media and whatnot. And just the ongoing stress they feel to succeed. I mean, we're a very motivated society. That can be another factor. And then just family relationships. You know, you see the dynamics and the trauma that can happen in families. I mean, those are the primary caregivers in many cases. In some cases, that can be wonderful. In other cases, it can be traumatic. But the more that you see divorce, death, violence, the more likely you are to have a mental health crisis.
Are there any things that you found at children's hospitals across the country that really do help kids and help nurture them and get them going on the road again so they feel better about themselves and about what's going on in the country and the world?
I would have to defer to the clinicians on that. But I think, again, treatment is a main thing. So I think just recognizing and returning to routines and stability and being those adults in kids' lives. And, you know, we often talk about the more than 700,000 people that have died of COVID-19. But the reality is 140,000 of those were primary or secondary caregivers for children in this country. So you look at the magnitude of loss that's just within that, and it is going to be traumatic. The Department of Education released some guidance earlier this year, which was really insightful. You know, they really recommended that, and, you know, obviously curriculum and teaching is a teacher's first job, but that the social and emotional learning was something that everyone needed to pay attention to. So I think schools and healthcare providers are starting, well, they've been doing the right things, but I think they have their finger on this, but it's going to take all of us. And it's going to take a while to turn the tide. I would say one thing that we certainly noticed where we sit as children's hospitals and other providers that provide this care for kids is that there's just not enough resources. And while we certainly have, you know, a real shortage in things like child and adolescent psychiatrists, the workforce that can treat these children is much broader than that. And we're suffering in those shortages everywhere from licensed social workers to behavioral health nurses to community navigators, kind of reinforcing that workforce and asking Congress and the administration to help break down some of those barriers and increase that capability will go a long way.
Okay, well, let's hope we can do something to turn this around because those numbers are really sobering as pediatricians call for a national emergency in children's mental health. Amy Knight, president of the Children's Hospital Association, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for paying attention to this very important issue.
Big news on the COVID vaccine front this week. After reviewing the data, the CDC made it official. Boosters are being recommended for those who got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And certain members of the population who got Moderna can also get a top off. those in certain categories who received the Pfizer shot were already eligible for the booster. Mixing and matching the boosters. A lot of people have been wondering about that. So let's break it down with ABC News Medical Unit Coordinating Producer Sony Salzman. The CDC and the FDA had said they really hoped not to confuse people with the latest guidance on booster shots. And the latest guidance on booster shots seems to maybe have confused people even more. Can you tell us exactly what happened this week and what's being allowed now that wasn't allowed at this time last week?
This week, what we really learned is that folks who originally got Moderna and Johnson & Johnson are also now eligible for a booster shot. Previously, it was just Pfizer. So here's where we stand. If you received Pfizer or Moderna, two shots that are pretty similar, they use similar technology, and you are older than 65, or you have a high risk of COVID because of an underlying medical condition or because of your occupation, you are eligible for a booster shot 6 months after your original vaccine. Now, if you're one of the 15 million people who got Johnson & Johnson, you are eligible for a booster shot 2 months after your vaccine if you're 18 or older, regardless of your underlying conditions or your age. The thing that has created some confusion is that there was some limited data suggesting that it is safe to mix your brand. So get a different shot as a booster than you originally received. And the CDC opened it up for anyone who would like to receive a different shot than the one they initially received. You are now allowed to do that under this CDC recommendation. I think this really speaks to the challenge that the CDC and the FDA had. And this has been the story of the pandemic, making hard calls with very limited information. So this study that we've all been talking about, this mix and match study, it relies on antibodies. Now, antibodies are important, but they do not paint the entire picture. So based on some antibody responses, it did look like folks who got Johnson & Johnson and then booster with Moderna or Pfizer had higher levels. But we know that that's not the whole picture when it comes to your overall immune response. So again, it's making those tough calls with limited information and not long-term information too. That study only went out for a few weeks.
What about people who got one of the Moderna or Pfizer and they work maybe in an office setting where there are not very many people, but they're under 65 and they don't have underlying conditions? Should they be out and getting one of these boosters right away, or is it something they can wait on?
If you feel like you have a high level of exposure through your occupation, then you technically qualify. You know, it is a tough call and it's going to be difficult for everyone to make that decision. The thing, Sherry, that I want to emphasize here, though, is that this entire conversation around booster shots has agonized the scientific advisors at the FDA and the CDC. I've been sitting through all of these meetings, and these folks, these are high-level scientists, they are very concerned that all of the conversation around booster shots has given America the false impression that their vaccines are no longer working, which could not be further from the truth. It is not urgent, if you are in a low risk category, to go out and get a booster right now because your vaccine is still working really well and it's doing what it intended to. Now, for certain people, certain high risk groups, it can give you a boost. For people with Johnson & Johnson, where vaccine efficacy was lower to start with, it can nudge you up to a higher level of efficacy than you had from the get-go. If what you care about is receiving a vaccine that protects you from being hospitalized or dying of this virus, all three vaccines are excellent choices and have remained relatively stable when you measure against that metric all the way out to like 6-8 months and seem to be continuously stable. If you care about just a breakthrough infection, that case of a cold, and you absolutely want to protect against that, getting that booster dose, sure, that will help.
Okay. And where do we stand as far as kids getting the vaccine?
There was data released that Pfizer's vaccine appears to be 91% effective in children 5 to 11. Great news. The FDA and its advisors will meet about that next week. And then from there, it's a multi-step process. The CDC also has to weigh in. We could see shots for children 5 to 11 in early November sometime.
Sony Salzman there, the coordinating producer for the ABC News Medical Unit. You've been hearing for weeks now about higher prices, empty store shelves, and ships waiting to be offloaded at ports on the West Coast. Who knew by this point in the pandemic we'd all be experts in supply chain disruptions? But we are. ABC News Chief Business and Economics Correspondent Rebecca Jarvis reminds us what's causing it.
So this goes back a long time, back to the beginning of the pandemic when everything shut down. Factories all over the world weren't working, but Americans were sitting on their couches and they started shopping and they started buying so much stuff. And suddenly there was this giant backlog because factories hadn't created items. People weren't working. There weren't enough people to bring the items to our homes and to homes across the world. And now we find ourselves in the most important season of all. It is the holiday shopping season when we buy more stuff than ever. Not enough stuff has been created. It's sitting in those backlogs. You see those cargo ships. Mm-hmm. It's waiting to get into stores. It's going to be a tough holiday season. A lot of big retailers like Target and Home Depot have commissioned their own cargo ships to bring this stuff from all over the world. But medium, small size retailers, they don't have that kind of control. And a lot of them are telling me they're getting cancellations for orders that were supposed to come in November. They're being told it's not coming till February. Wow. Well, try and buy that for Christmas.
President Biden pushed 24/7 port operations ahead of what's expected to be a strong holiday shopping season. ABC's Alex Stone has been reporting on the issue from California, where ships have been unable to unload at some of the nation's biggest ports. He's got the latest from the West Coast.
Off the coast of L.A., Sherry, it is a parking lot, a record set of 100 cargo ships anchored, unable to unload because so many cargo containers are stacked up on the docks at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach waiting to be moved out on trucks and via train. And there are dozens more ships heading this way. Spots to anchor are full. There is no more room, but they're still coming. And the docks are full of containers, gridlock trying to get them moved out to warehouses where the furniture, electronics, toys, and cars need to go. Truck drivers say they can wait hours to get a load. Partners in the supply chain say there aren't enough truck drivers or warehouses for everything coming in. All the way in Kansas, truck driving instructor David John says he's never seen so much demand for drivers.
I have recruiters from different trucking companies calling me every day asking for drivers.
You may be saying, okay, how does a backlog at the Port of Los Angeles impact me? I don't live nearby. It's the biggest port in the country. What you buy, if it comes from Asia, probably enters here. And the lack of truck drivers in general will impact everybody.
Those days that you can order something on Amazon and the next day or 2 days it's there on your doorstep. Well, maybe be now be 1 week or 2 weeks.
Here in California, Governor Gavin Newsom is ordering that new trucking routes be opened by lifting road weight limits and is ordering more short-term storage to be found to warehouse containers. With products waiting weeks on ships, prices are going up. At Procter & Gamble, staple items that help you shave and wash your clothes, they're getting more expensive.
I cannot comment on future price increases, but we'll continue to evolve as the situation evolves.
It means things like toys and video games for the holidays may not make it or may be very limited in supply. Candace Williams owns the Toy Maven in Dallas. She says the supply chain in general is messed up right now.
We've seen just a litany of missed shipments, things that have gone to the wrong store, duplications, or just a lot of errors along that part of the supply chain that we normally don't see.
Now, other ports, like in Oakland, they're saying ships should go there. They're not overwhelmed. They have plenty of room. They're making the call for ships to divert from L.A. to Oakland or to Miami rather than sit for weeks waiting to unload in L.A. Brian Brandis is a director of maritime at the Port of Oakland.
We are part of the solution to stabilize the supply chain. So we're talking with ocean carriers to offer relief from the other ports.
But of course, there's a problem. Shipping companies and those receiving the goods say L.A. is set up to be the main hub on the West Coast. It's where the trucks are. It's where the trains come in. It's where the warehouses are nearby to store items as they get distributed out. Oakland is more popular for exporting agricultural goods and logistically bringing in goods 300 miles from the warehouses where they need to be doesn't make a lot of sense. Brandis says that could be overcome.
Absolutely not the right way to go. We can't handle all of the additional cargo, but we can handle a significant portion of it.
Bottom line, there appear to be no quick fixes. President Biden is ordering the ports of LA and Long Beach to go into hyperdrive and work 24/7. Port officials say they've pretty much been going 24/7 anyway, but there is so much cargo coming in, it can't be trucked away fast enough, and there is not enough warehouse space to move it into. In the meantime, there are still so many cargo ships just off the coast here waiting to unload. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News, in Los Angeles.
Coming up, that walkout at Netflix, how the company is responding now to the backlash over the new Dave Chappelle special on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the NFL confronts race norming, but first. Comedian Dave Chappelle has been making people feel uncomfortable again. You might say it's become his trademark, saying things that folks don't like. This time, though, members of the trans community say he went way too far in his latest Netflix stand-up special. They say Dave Chappelle's transphobic message promotes bigotry and hatred.
I asked you, why is it easier for Bruce Jenner to change his gender than it is for Cassius Clay to change his name?
That's just a tiny snippet of the special. Outside the Netflix offices this week, there were protests.
We're not here to prove anything to them. We're here to speak directly to Netflix. We tried to speak to Dave Chappelle. He was not having the conversation. So now we're here to communicate directly with the people who signed the checks and also to let Netflix know that we're not going away.
Netflix employees walking out in support and many of those working remotely closing their laptops in solidarity. Transgender Netflix employee Tara Field was one of the organizers.
So often, only the mocking stories are told about us, but nobody talks about how beautiful our truth is when we get to live it.
Field was an outspoken critic of the company on Twitter and was suspended, but then reinstated for attending a quarterly business review meeting at the company to which she wasn't invited. To sort out all the facts on this, we turn to Maureen Ryan, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, who talked about it with ABC's Brad Milkey as a part of our daily podcast. Start here.
Netflix has had a long-standing relationship with Dave Chappelle. I believe this is his sixth special for Netflix. Apparently, they perform really well for Netflix. They're popular. Netflix has become a huge force in comedy, and he's one of the centerpiece offerings of that.
Any of you who have ever watched me know that I have never had a problem with transgender people. If you listen to what I'm saying, clearly my problem has always been with white people.
It's not just the first time that Dave Chappelle has talked about trans people. It is the fourth within these Netflix specials.
Gay people get mad at me, lesbians get mad at me, but I'm gonna tell you right now, and this is true, these transgenders, these want me dead.
Immediately, there were reactions from trans people. And some of those reactions were actually just critiques of the material. You know, this is not fresh material. This is not interesting. But it's also, in some people's view, harmful.
Glad weighing in, tweeting Dave Chappelle's brand has become synonymous with ridiculing trans people and other marginalized communities.
It's a harmful thing for a trans person to exist in the world. Trans people are at risk for homelessness, they're at risk for unemployment, they're at risk for poverty, they're at risk for violence to be done to them.
And from National Black Justice Coalition President David J. Johns, with 2021 on track to be the deadliest year on record for transgender people in the United States, the majority of whom are black transgender people, Netflix should know better.
So the problem is not that Dave Chappelle has jokes he wants to tell. The problem is, where are they being platformed? How are they being promoted?
One Netflix employee who is trans tweeted a thread that's getting a lot of attention, calling Chappelle's views harmful.
But then, internally at Netflix, there is a trans group, an employee resource group. They have been working within the company for some time to address issues to do with trans representation on Netflix and then how trans employees are treated within Netflix as a company.
But isn't that, I mean, is there not something to that? I mean, Netflix is the company that puts out the Chappelle special, sure. They're also the company that puts out Orange is the New Black. Laverne Cox becomes the first trans woman to win an Emmy after rising to prominence there. They essentially relaunch Queer Eye. I mean, Netflix does seem like it's saying, look, yeah, we entertain literally the entire world. Sorry.
Well, but also the thing is they want to go pick up awards and gain all the kudos of they want to promote. Oh, we have an array of creators that is more inclusive than many other people in the industry.
We're the Fab Five from Netflix's Queer Eye.
You cannot say we are putting content into the world that we think is making the world better and then also assert, oh, except for this thing over here, that's not creating any harm.
Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos apologizing this week, saying there were employees who were feeling pain and hurt from the decision to air the special, and he should have acknowledged that. Of course, he went on to say storytelling has real impact in the real world. That impact can be hugely positive and can be quite negative. Maureen Ryan, contributing editor there with Vanity Fair, speaking with ABC's Brad Milkey for our daily podcast, Start Here. The NFL and former players reached agreement to end race norming in concussion settlement programs after several months of confidential negotiations. Following an ABC News investigation earlier this year, a federal judge overseeing the program ordered the NFL and attorneys for former players into mediation to address the concerns about the use of the controversial practice. ABC's Janae Norman breaks down the story.
The NFL pledging to end the use of the controversial practice of race norming, a neuropsychological tool that, when used in these cases, assumes black players start at a lower cognitive level than white players, often making it harder, critics claim, for black former players and their families to qualify for compensation for head injuries sustained during their careers. Coming after an ABC News investigation uncovered emails from several clinicians who evaluated players saying they felt pressured to apply race-based adjustments to former players' cognitive test scores that, quote, bottom line, do discriminate against black players. The new terms meant to be filed under seal, but ABC News learning that in that 46-page document, the NFL and other parties state that no race norms or demographic estimates, whether black or white, shall be used in the settlement program going forward. In June, the NFL pledging to end the use of the controversial practice of race norming.
ABC's Kira Phillips talked about it with one former NFLer who was denied compensation, Lewis Leonard and his wife, Lacey.
Lewis, I have to start with you. How have you been feeling? Because I know you have been very open talking about dealing with memory loss, a lot of anger, depression. Tell us just how you've been feeling and moving forward.
It don't seem that my issues are easing up. Tell you, the last 2 months probably been the hardest that I had this year. But you know, my family keep me going. My wife keeps me motivated. My boys keeps me motivated. But tell you the truth, it hasn't been the best. It hasn't been the best. So I just try to keep on going.
As you both know, an investigation we did here earlier this year uncovered emails and data suggesting that the league's protocols made it more difficult for black former players like you, Leonard, to qualify for compensation. And according to this new 46-page document, it seems like this is an attempt to even the playing field. How were black players not receiving equal treatment? And you can both weigh in on this. Let's start with you, Lacey.
So basically what they were doing was they were making it more difficult for the black players to be able to receive their benefits because they assumed that neurocognitively that black men were slower. So they would have to score higher on the test than say a white former retired NFL player to qualify for their benefits. Now in my husband's particular case, he had received his approval for the NFL concussion settlement. They went through an entire audit and they found no adverse findings in my husband's claim. And right before they were supposed to administer the claim, we received notification that his claim was then overturned. And they said that, oh, well, they didn't account for certain norms, including norms with race. So to me, I just couldn't understand how they would deny a player for not allocating for race when race should not determine if there's been any type of neurocognitive damage, if there's any type of brain damage. Race shouldn't be a factor of that. So basically, the NFL was strategically placing norms so that Black players, former players, would have to score higher than, say, a white retired player. And that's what has been happening. That's what's happened to my husband.
Lewis, what more do you want to see done?
I want to see not only myself, but my brothers who I went to war with be able to get some type of restitution and some type of quality life, because you know you play in the NFL and you're fortunate enough to say, hey, I'm retired from the NFL, but yeah, you don't feel like it. I had to leave the NFL due to injuries, and I was dealing with it when I was in the league, when you talk about depression and things of that sort, but I just never knew what it was. But now that I'm retired and I know that the league is done, and to still sit here and think about, you know, what the next 10 or 20 years going to be if I can't get up and do what I need to do to provide for my family. It's tough. It's heartbreaking. I got two young boys that's growing like weeds. And sometimes it hurts me even more to be broke down and in a bed or locked up in a room. So really, I just hope that the NFL and these judges and these lawyers can come up with some type of way to give the players the benefits, allow us to receive the funds that we have went to war for, and actually be able to give us a chance to live a quality life after being retired.
Lacey, Lewis Leonard, thank you so much for sharing your story. Appreciate it.
Oh, very much. We appreciate you guys.
We really appreciate you having us.
Some Latinos are facing community criticism over Spanish-speaking skills. ABC News correspondent Stephanie Ramos talked to dual language expert Dr. Jose Medina about destigmatizing Spanglish and the challenges some Latino children face for being unable to speak fluent Spanish.
This is Dr. Jose Medina.
For those of you that don't remember what chisme means, remember it means chisme.
A dual language expert using TikTok to destigmatize Spanglish.
Adios. I don't know what Spanglish speaker needs to hear this today, pero ahí les va. Don't ever apologize for being fabulous.
His page has more than 1 million likes.
Ay, pues mira, mira. So I'm a published researcher, author, all of these things, but it's crazy. Like recently, what people know me for is TikTok, which is just loquísimo para mí that people have connected with the TikToks that I've created.
His videos cover a variety of tough cultural topics in the Latino community. One of the more popular subjects, Yo No Sabo Kids.
Do you know what you just did? You moved planchando and you moved ironing and you combined them to say planching.
Yo No Sabo is a twist on the phrase I don't know and has become a term for kids of Latino parents who have grown up in the United States and cannot speak Spanish fluently.
People often use that Yo No Sabo label, which is actually really destructive, because what we're saying in fact is that these students that grew up in the United States but were never afforded an opportunity to strengthen that home language, instead they were forced to transition to English. Now we're ridiculing them and saying, oh, well, you don't know how to conjugate saber in Spanish, which is crazy, because these students that we so often ridicule bring it fabulousness in terms of their linguistic repertoire.
Some Latino children in the U.S. serve as their family's only liaison to American culture. Others have been discouraged from speaking Spanish at all. In 1918, several states made speaking any other language besides English in schools illegal, and these laws weren't repealed until Congress passed the Bilingual Education Act in 1968. But many Latino parents still encouraged their children to only speak English so they could assimilate into American culture.
I think that the reason that we have No Sabo Kids is because we felt oppression not just in schools, but also at home.
Meet Robert Aguilera. He had never heard of a Yo No Sabo Kid. Robert grew up in a suburb of Rochester, New York, in a middle to upper class neighborhood. And although his parents, one Cuban and the other Puerto Rican, could speak Spanish, Robert never picked it up.
I think being in the suburban area I grew up in, I think it's just like hard to like incorporate that. Even when my parents went outside too, like they didn't have many opportunities to speak Spanish.
When did you decide that it was important to learn the language?
I was a senior in college. I had like just completely forgotten about Spanish. Like it just wasn't even on my radar. So I was just like, man, like I'm so sick of trying to like fit in. Like either I'm Latino or I'm like super American. Like it's, you know, it's one of the two. And I always felt like people were trying to push me to the side, you know. We went to Italy and I remember the last day we were there, we went to a bar and there were these two Cuban guys playing guitar. And I remember sitting at the table and I was like, man, like we're probably like the only people like of Cuban descent. I wish so bad like I could just go up to these people and just start talking to them.
Eventually, he quit his job in California as an industrial designer to live in Puerto Rico. Robert enrolled in Spanish Sin Pena, a program based in California for Latinos wanting to reconnect with their culture and learn Spanish. Jackie Rodriguez and Wendy Ramirez are the co-founders of Sin Pena. They want to show Latinos that while not knowing Spanish doesn't make someone any less Latino, it can help speakers advocate for their community.
Not being able to speak Spanish and communicate Spanish and identifying with the Latino culture has created a lot of wounds for a lot of people.
So many of us feel isolated in this. Like we feel like we might be the only one who gets made fun of at family parties or the only one who doesn't speak perfectly.
How difficult was it to learn and catch up?
Remember the first time I talked with my dad, it was so choppy. Like I couldn't put together sentences. Like I'm a very like organized, like structured person. So I kind of had my routine and I just kind of stuck to it. Now I feel really good about my Spanish. To be Latino or to be Latinx, like you don't have to like learn Spanish. I think it's definitely a personal decision, but it just opens this new world for you. Like you learn about like so much more content. That's been the most powerful thing.
Finally, in Washington, D.C., an anniversary for a memorial. The granite statue honoring Dr. Martin Luther King that sits on the edge of the National Mall was dedicated 10 years ago. On that day, President Obama's keynote read, "Let us remember that change has never been quick. Change has never been simple or without controversy. Change depends on persistence." His then Vice President, now President, Joe Biden, spoke at this week's ceremony.
We now face an inflection point in the battle literally for the soul of America. And it's up to us together to choose who we want to be and what we want to be.
And the president agreed with his former boss, change has not come easy and is still a work in progress. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Eric Mollo. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.